Brothers and sisters, if you don't change your ways, you are on the road to Jam Nation. Welcome, everybody, to episode 35 of Road to Jam Nation. In this episode, I'll begin revealing my top 20 favorite albums of 1969, after my last two previous episodes did a review of some of the musical trends of 1969 and discussed some of the key albums that highlighted each of those musical trends that I discussed. Before I dive into my actual top 20, I'll also mention that I started this episode off by playing a clip of the two-song medley by The Fifth Dimension, Aquarius / Let the Sunshine In. These two songs both came from the songbook of the 1967 musical Hair. And, as noted, it was a two-song medley that was released as one single by The Fifth Dimension in 1969. I played a 30-second clip of the Aquarius portion of that song. One interesting note is that these two songs were actually recorded in two separate recording sessions in two different studios, and then they were later edited together into what wound up becoming a fairly seamless popular medley of the two songs. This single wound up spending 6 weeks at number one in the United States during the spring of 1969. The Fifth Dimension were a vocal group who were founded in Los Angeles, California, and their origins started in 1965 when they were called the Versatiles. It didn't become long before the group had renamed themselves the Fifth Dimension in 1966. This two-song medley is one of the most well-remembered singles by the group, but all in all, the group wound up charting 20 hits on the American Top 40 between 1967 and 1973. Probably the only single that competes with Aquarius' Let the Sunshine In would have been Up, Up and Away, which was a number 7 hit for the group in 1967. This 1969 hit was the group's highest chart success, and it wound up winning a Grammy Award for the group for Record of the Year. Anyway, I'm not a particularly big fan of what I think is a little bit of the overly slick style of the Fifth Dimension, but I do respect them and what they accomplished during their career. And as a teenager, I definitely became familiar with the band's former member, Marilyn McCoo, who wound up being one of the hosts of the musical variety television show Solid Gold in the 1980s, which was one of the few avenues that I had as a country boy in the early 1980s to see music performers, since we didn't have MTV in Fallon, Nevada. So, anyway, like I said, I wasn't a big fan, so the Fifth Dimension was not in any way a contender for my top 20, but since I hadn't discussed them during the past two episodes, I did think that it was important to highlight the group, because they were very much an important part of the sound of 1969, with their slick version of Sunshine Vocal Pop. Now, let's get into my top 20. My number 20 favorite album of 1969 was by Blind Faith, and the album was self-titled as Blind Faith. You are the reason I've been waiting so long. Somebody holds a key. Well, I'm nearly at just thank God the time. And I'm wasted and I can't find my way. Blind Faith was a promising supergroup that imploded quickly due to the weight of pressure from the music industry and from fan expectations. Eric Clapton had broken up Cream, feeling creatively restricted within the band, and also being tired of the constant animosity between drummer Ginger Baker and bassist singer Jack Bruce. Clapton wanted the freedom to experiment with a wider stylistic range than the hard blues that Cream had been focused on. Clapton was close friends with Steve Winwood of the band Traffic, and Winwood at the time also was ready to leave his band Traffic, feeling that the band had pretty much run its creative course. Winwood and Clapton began to jam together, with Clapton planning to record a solo album with Winwood's help. News of the collaboration between these two musicians leaked, and there was soon huge pressure from concert promoters for the two of them to tour together, and questions as to when this album that they were supposed to work on would be released, even though the album was merely a hope for Clapton at this point, rather than any active project that he actually had a contract for producing. Ginger Baker, when he heard of this collaboration through the music media, wound up inviting himself over to jam with Clapton and Winwood. And even though Eric Clapton didn't particularly want to work with Ginger Baker again, due to Baker's difficult personality, he wound up being talked into it by Steve Winwood, who rightfully pointed out that there was no way they were going to find a more suitable or qualified drummer to play with than Ginger Baker, who was one of the most technically knowledgeable drummers in the English music scene. This new band was completed by recruiting Rick Gretsch of the British prog rock band Family. This also wound up being a bit of a mistake that likely led to the short duration of this band. Gretsch was a talented musician, but he had a major drug problem, which made him an unreliable performer when on tour. This unreliability didn't mesh well with the fussy musical perfectionism that Eric Clapton had at the time. This being before Eric Clapton had fully devolved into his own drug addiction issues that he would run into several years later. This new group was rushed into the studio without much time to prepare very many songs. But the songs the group did produce were pretty outstanding in my opinion. Had to Cry Today, Sea of Joy, and especially the song Can't Find My Way Home by Steve Winwood, as well as Clapton's song, Presence of the Lord. All were exceptional songs that showed the promise of this talented band working together. But that's all that this band had managed to create when they went into the music studio. So they wound up rounding out the album with an excellent cover of Buddy Holly's song, Well All Right, as well as a 15-minute long instrumental jam. When the group wound up being pressured to go out and tour, despite lack of time to practice and to gel as a group, it wound up destroying whatever enthusiasm had been in place as the group was originally created. Eric Clapton was completely unsatisfied with the quality of their live performances. And I will say that Clapton kind of has a point. When you look at music videos or listen to tapes of the band's live performances, even of great material like Can't Find My Way Home, those performances definitely sound fairly ragged by the musical standards that these musicians usually held themselves to. Also, without adequate original material to fill out an entire set as concert headliners, this band had to perform Cream songs and Traffic songs in order to fill out their time on stage. This led to the audiences expecting and demanding the Cream material and paying little attention to the new material from this band's album. Eric Clapton felt like he was reliving the very reasons why he had left Cream in the first place. And he also felt annoyed by the adulation that the band received for what he felt were subpar technical performances of the older fan-favorite material. As the group's tour went on, Clapton began spending most of his time focused on the tour's opening act, which was Delaney and Bonnie and Friends. By the end of the tour, Traffic was over as a band. So that's all a rather sad and disappointing story. But this album is the one great monument left behind by this brief musical collaboration. Despite its rushed nature, it is still an excellent listen, showing all the promise of what this group could have accomplished if it had been given time to truly settle in and become a cohesive band rather than being pressured to get out on the road before they were really ready to. Let's listen to one more cut from this album now. Enjoy! Next, my number 19 favorite album of 1969. The album was It's a Beautiful Day, and this album was also self-titled as It's a Beautiful Day. It's a Beautiful Day was a great band with a beautiful jam rock style that was born in San Francisco as part of the Summer of Love scene. The songs White Bird and Hot Summer Day are the well-known songs that still get some airplay on classic rock radio.
But the white bird just sits in her cage.
But there are some other really trippy songs on the album beyond those songs, such as the song Girl with No Eyes, that definitely sounds like the type of lyrics that somebody came up with while on an intense acid trip.
Girl with no eyes, who can she be? The girl with no eyes, she's looking at me. There's a girl in my room and her face on the wall with no eyes. If I make a sound, she'll know that I'm stirring inside. If I make a sound, she'll know that I'm trying to hide.
It's a Beautiful Day had great band interplay on the music and a nice blend of male and female voices that did excellent vocal harmonies. This debut album also has one of the greatest album covers of all time, and the vinyl version of this is one of my most prized possessions in the collection of vinyl albums that I still maintain. Unfortunately, this band's story was a hard luck one, as the band's fortunes kept them from ever achieving the kind of true stardom that a few of the other major bands from San Francisco were able to gain. The band had management problems with Matthew Katz, a man who had been a problem for the early version of Jefferson Airplane, and also wound up completely destroying the group Moby Grape with his shady management. Matthew Katz's management led to this band being sequestered away from the popular clubs in San Francisco, and instead being placed in a residency at a poorly attended club that was owned by Katz himself in Seattle. It's a Beautiful Day spent the majority of the psychedelic era hidden away in this small club. They finally broke away from that situation, and the band hooked up with Bill Graham, and Bill Graham was able to arrange for the band to record this debut album in 1969, getting them signed to Columbia Records. Katz wound up suing the band, claiming ownership of the name of the band, and asking for rights to the band's first two Columbia albums due to having the recording contract for the band as well. Katz wound up losing the initial lawsuit, which allowed the band to move forward with their Columbia contract and achieve a radio hit with the single White Bird off of this album. Bill Graham was also now providing them booking in his clubs, with much fuller audiences. When the promoters of Woodstock reached out to Bill Graham to help with their festival, they asked him to help them to get the Grateful Dead to sign a contract to perform at Woodstock. Graham told the Woodstock promoters that if he was going to get them the Grateful Dead, he wanted them to also book one of the two new bands that he was trying to break, those two bands being Santana and It's a Beautiful Day. The Woodstock promoters were reported to have simply flipped the coin and gave the booking to Santana, and the Santana band became instant stars due to their historic performance at that festival. It's a Beautiful Day didn't get a spot at the festival, and are now a bit of a musical footnote, known mostly to deep fans of the San Francisco sound such as myself. Katz wound up following an appeal to the original court finding. And in his appeal, Katz wound up winning, and wound up being granted ownership of the music from It's a Beautiful Day's first two albums off of Columbia, as well as ownership of the excellent cover art of that debut album that I spoke of. This situation kept It's a Beautiful Day from being able to do reissues of their best-known work as the 80s and 90s CD reissue revolution hit. It's really a shame. It's a Beautiful Day were a great band that deserved to be more than a minor footnote in rock history. But instead, they wound up being a band that had all of the money stolen from their initial successes and wound up being kept from being able to perform for many years and were kept from people being able to find copies of their music anywhere other than in used record stores. Anyway, let's listen to one more song from this great band. Enjoy!
Precious time, lovely time, all the time. Time, 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 time.
And now, my number 18 favorite album of 1969, which was by King Crimson, and the album was their debut album, In the Court of the Crimson King. This debut album by King Crimson has managed to somehow stay pretty much purely a cult-following type of musical artifact, despite decades of musical excellence and constant evolution. Although perhaps it is that constant change in the band's sound and personnel that has partially helped to keep the band from growing a bigger audience. King Crimson had only formed in 1968, having come out of the ashes of a number of failed British bands. The band was formed explicitly from the start with the intention of producing complicated non-commercial music. King Crimson were influenced by the Moody Blues to incorporate classical melodic compositions, and they fused that with a love for jazz improvisation and complex polyrhythms and intricate, difficult musicianship. King Crimson's playing skills made the band a favorite for fellow musicians, but their refusal to compromise their musical vision at all for commercial radio play kept them from ever crossing over to mainstream pop appeal.
Just use up my time. I talk to the wind. My words are all carried away. I talk to the wind.
King Crimson's influence spans across the subgenres that grew in the wake of their innovations. The band are considered one of the first progressive rock bands, while their sometimes aggressive musical pieces were an influence on the heavy metal bands of the 1970s, and the band's avoidance of typical blues-based influences in their rock sound was influential on the emerging krautrock scene, as well as the overall progressive genre that they were one of the instigators for. The band are beloved by many of the alternative music bands of the 1980s and 90s. And yes, the band are also a huge influence on many bands in the modern jam band scene that I love. My own personal interest in King Crimson tends to waver a bit depending on the era of the band that I'm listening to. The various versions of this band constantly absorbed new influences. And the band definitely went through a bunch of different lineup changes, as I think I've already indicated here before. Some eras of this band, I adore the music that they made, and other eras I find to be just a bit too pretentious and tedious. But even in the eras when I didn't particularly like the band's albums, I still love to watch videos of their live musical performances, because the musicians that went through this band have all been pretty extraordinary, and their compositions and improvisational skills give them every chance to display their vast musical talents. Anyway, all of that covers the broad spectrum of this band's complicated career. But in this case, we're at the embryonic stage of this band, with this debut album, which is a very impressive and interesting album. Although the song selections on this album can be a little bit hit or miss, which is why it didn't rank a little bit higher. The best songs on this album are amongst the most thrilling music made in 1969. But when it's not all clicking, this is also an album that highlights some of the pretentious overreach that many bands of this era were guilty of. Let's listen to one more number off this album now. Enjoy! My number 17 favorite album of 1969 was The Meters, and it was self-titled as The Meters, the third self-titled album that I've covered so far in four albums for this year. The Meters are one of the best funk groove bands of all time, able to stand toe-to-toe with James Brown's best ensembles. But The Meters never had the dynamic frontman that would have helped to put the band over the top. The greatest career success of The Meters came in being the backing band to other stars. They worked as the studio band for the records that Alan Toussaint produced in the 1960s. They backed up Dr. John in his career-defining early albums, and they were the backing band for Robert Palmer during his early solo career. The Meters brought in the rhythms of the New Orleans second line parades, and they fused those rhythms with R&B influences and with the funk arrangement innovations of James Brown to make instrumental grooves that are heavily sampled to this very day. In 1969, The Meters released both of their first two albums of their career. The self-titled album was one of those, and the other album was called Look Kapai Pai. That second album tends to get the lion's share of the critical praise these days, but I personally think that this debut album is the one that lays out the band's basic musical vision, and it was that vision that the band continued to build on for their following albums. So personally, this debut album is the one that I personally gravitate to for 1969. Thank you. The songs on this album are foundational elements of funk music, and the band's funky style would be shamelessly stolen on to build disco hits later in the 1970s for dance-oriented rock songs by jazz musicians interested in adding a little bit more funk vibe to their jazz, and later to provide the samples for the early versions as well as the modern versions of hip-hop music. And the band's music has even been drawn on by hippie jam band musicians who would learn how to use the rhythmic structures of the meter's grooves to provide solid platforms on which to build their own musical improvisations. This band is criminally unappreciated. There's entire generations of new musicians that still build great new dance songs that shamelessly mine the rhythmic ideas that this band introduced. Let's listen to one more of their great songs here. Enjoy. Next up, my number 16 favorite album of 1969, which was by Frank Zappa, and the album was Hot Rats. Frank Zappa disbanded the original Mothers of Invention lineup in 1969. The band had not been very successful in the United States, and Zappa often was financially supporting the band members out of his own pocket between tours. Zappa had also grown frustrated that the audiences for Mothers concerts seemed not to fully appreciate the instrumental music that he had been adding into the band's live performances. Zappa at this point was composing jazz-influenced music, as well as music he termed electronic chamber music, and those styles were becoming his primary creative interest. But that style also clashed with the satirical nature of the songs that had dominated the style of the 1960s Mothers of Invention albums. The fifth album by the Mothers of Invention was also released in 1969, built from sessions before Zappa had decided to break up the band. And those last recording sessions, as well as bits and pieces of various other leftovers from previous album outtakes, wound up providing enough material for two more Mothers of Invention albums that would wind up being released the following year in 1970. This solo album, Hot Rats, was Zappa's first release after this breakup, and it is almost all instrumental, with the exception of the song Willie the Pimp, which has vocals supplied by Frank Zappa's childhood friend, Captain Beefheart.
I'm a little pimp with my hair gas black, hair candy pants with my shoes shine black. Got a little lady walk that street, telling all the boys it's crazy. $20 bill, I can sit you straight. Meet me on the corner, boy, I don't.
This is the first studio album to make significant use of Zappa's skills as a guitar soloist. And it is this album that helped to cement Frank Zappa's status as a true musical visionary. Hot Rats was hugely influential to the leader of the world's current biggest jam band, Phish. While Phish is well known for borrowing their touring business model and their fan-friendly taping policies from the Grateful Dead, as well as following the Grateful Dead's love of group improvisation, musically, the song compositions of Phish are much more influenced by Frank Zappa's work. And much of that influence can be heard here in this Hot Rats album, which is one of the reasons I am so fond of this album, as a modern jam band fan, and specifically as a fan of the music of Phish. So anyway, let's listen to one more song from Frank Zappa. Enjoy! Next, my number 15 favorite album of 1969, which was by Sly and the Family Stone, and the album was Stand.
We got to live together. I am no better, neither are you. We are the same, whatever we do. You love me, you hate me.
Stand was the fourth album by Sly and the Family Stone, and it would be the most successful album that they put out. Sly and the Family Stone were a San Francisco-based band that was a multi-ethnic and multi-gender band that was indeed centered around the so-called Family Stone. Sly, the leader of the group, his brother Freddie on guitar, and his sister Rose on keyboards. The Family Stone's big band approach to funk and soul music, as well as their rock guitar compositions, and the slapping style of their bass player, Larry Graham, had an immediate huge impact on the musical direction of both established bands, such as The Temptations, who would transition to their psychedelic soul phase, largely due to the musical influence of hearing Sly and the Family Stone, and also influence on new bands that were emerging, such as George Clinton's formation of his new funkadelic band in 1970, on which Clinton would pursue a much more guitar-focused version of funk and soul music than he had been making with his band Parliament, who he would still continue to work with as well. And the more anthemic songs created by Sly and the Family Stone have remained a source of inspiration for generations of new bands ever since. Along with the title song, Stand, this album also features some true classics, such as Everyday People, I Want to Take You Higher, You Can Make It If You Try, and Sing a Simple Song.
Yes, man. let me hear you say.
All of these are stone cold classic songs, but the deep cuts are good as well. This really is an outstanding album by an outstanding band. Let's listen to one more cut here. Enjoy. My number 14 favorite album of 1969 was from Miles Davis, and the album was In a Silent Way. On Miles Davis's previous two albums before this one, and on the live performances during the prior 2 years before 1969, Miles Davis had begun experimenting with the use of electronic instruments in his music, adding in electric keyboards and electric bass to his band. On In a Silent Way, Miles Davis adds John McLaughlin to the band. McLaughlin was an electric guitar player who had been experimenting with the fusion of jazz and rock music in his playing for most of the 1960s. In a Silent Way is a very mellow album, but the music on it sets the stage for the sort of intense space rock explosion of Miles Davis's 1970 masterpiece album, Bitches Brew. In a Silent Way would be recorded as a series of studio improvisations, and then the album's producer, Tio Macero, edited those jam sessions and used them to construct two album tracks, one track for each side of this LP, with each track being formatted into a three-part sonata. The fact that the final songs presented on this album were constructed through studio editing rather than simply presenting the best takes from the studio sessions wound up being very controversial in the jazz community. That controversy, coupled with the ambivalence of jazz critics about the increased use of electronic instrumentation, caused many to declare this album to not actually be true jazz. Many of these critics saw this sort of music as selling out to the commercial pop music industry. That criticism, in fact, played right into the desires of Miles Davis. At this point in his career, Davis didn't like being pigeonholed as a jazz musician. He wanted the freedom to simply explore his musical muse wherever it would take him, without concern for the limitations of genre, form, or musical precedent. I have always admired that trait of Miles Davis tremendously. And I do like this album very much, thus its place on this list here. Though I do not like this album as much as I love Bitches Brew, or Jack Johnson, which came out after Bitches Brew, and which I consider to be my actual favorite album by Miles Davis. Davis had assembled the perfect band for these stunningly brilliant albums. And on this particular album, he's still feeling around a bit for just exactly what he can do with that band. But what he's doing with them here is very exciting stuff. But it's still an embryonic form of what would be truly earth-shattering music to come. And now, my number 13 favorite album of 1969, which was by Led Zeppelin, and it was their second album that was titled 2 with Roman numerals 2.
You need cool.
Both of the first two albums by Led Zeppelin were released in 1969, and both had to be given serious consideration for a spot on this list. Led Zeppelin's debut was a musical sea change that attracts imitators to this very day, and it has a compelling purity of intention to it, as the band laid out its vision of the hardest and loudest blues-based rock music that had been made to that point in time. That first album displayed all of the strengths of the band's perfect power trio formation, with the huge rhythmic foundation of John Bonham on drums, and John Paul Jones on bass, and Jimmy Page on stunning guitar riff assault. And it added to that core trio the vocal acrobatics of their lead singer, Robert Plant, who had a vocal style that in many ways was a male version of Janis Joplin. But it is on this second album, with the Tolkien-inspired English folklore of the song Ramble On, and the acoustically-based song What Is and What Should Never Be, in which Led Zeppelin quickly displayed that they had much more in their plans than to simply be a harder, louder, and faster version of the Yardbirds.
The wind has been sailed away, leave the day way high in the sky.
Ramble On, in particular, is a highlight of this album, as I consider it one of my top five favorite Led Zeppelin songs.
Just in the darkest depths of Mordor, I met a girl so fair. But Gollum and the evil one crept up and slipped away with her.
there's really not a bad track on the entire album, as there seldom were for any of the early Led Zeppelin albums. It's hard to think of what else to say about a band that is so well known and beloved that hasn't already been said by many people before me. So perhaps it's best to just listen to the music. Here's another song. Enjoy.
With a purple umbrella and a 50-cent hand. Live it, love it. She's just the warm up the school rides out in her age Cadillac. Live it, love it. She's just the warm up. Come on, babe, on the roundabout. Rattle the merry-go-round. We all know what the name is.
Next up, my number 12 favorite album of 1969, which was by Creedence Clearwater Revival. And the album was Willie and the Poor Boys.
Early in the evening, just about supper time, over by the courthouse, they're starting to unwind. Four kids on the corner, trying to bring you up. Willie picks a tune out, and he blows it on the hum. Down on the corner, in the street, then the poor boys are playing, bring the nick up happy feet.
This album is my favorite of three albums that were released by CCR during this explosive year of creativity for the band.
When I was a little bitty baby, my mama would rock me in the cradle in them old cotton field back home. It was down in Louisiana, just about a mile from Texarkana, in them old cotton fields back home.
All three of their albums from this year have some truly classic hits and some extremely satisfying deep cuts on them. But it is this album, Willie and the Poor Boys, that I think has no weak moment on it at all.
Some folks are born made to wave the flag. Ooh, they're red, white,
The album Green River tends to get the lion's share of historical attention, and that album was a consideration as well. But there's a couple of weaker songs among that album's deep cuts that go along with its big hits. By the time of Willie and the Poor Boys, the third album of the year from CCR, John Fogerty was really in his songwriting comfort zone, on the way to making the 1970 album Cosmos Factory, which to me is the band's best album. Cosmos Factory is an album so flawlessly good that it really could have easily just been called a greatest hits album. There's just that many classic songs on that album. The albums from 1969 are great as well. They just don't quite hit at that same level of perfection as that 1970 album. CCR came together as a high school band in California in 1959, originally under the name The Blue Velvets. The band released some singles on a small Oakland-based record label. In 1964, the band was signed to a recording contract by the jazz label Fantasy Records, based out of San Francisco. Fantasy Records renamed the band the Gollywogs. As the Gollywogs, the band didn't make much of an impact with their singles, and the dynamics of the band began to shift after this. Initially, the band had been fronted by Tom Fogerty, who was the eldest member of the band and the older brother of John Fogerty. During their years as the Gollywogs, John Fogerty gradually exerted more control as the songwriter for the band's original songs, and he eventually elbowed his way in to become the lead singer. In 1968, their band would finally change their name to Creedence Clearwater Revival, and they released their first full-length album in that year, containing their first hit song with the jammed out cover of Susie Q. Having finally caught some national attention, John Fogerty dug deep and solidified his absolute control over the band, rejecting the pressure from other band members who wanted to supply their own songs, and rejecting their musical ideas when they wanted to alter the song arrangements as they had been envisioned by John. John's instincts at this time were absolutely golden, as all three of these 1969 albums would wind up being top 10 albums, with Green River being a number one album, a feat that they never actually achieved with any of their songs. Though the band released five top 40 singles during the year, three of those went to number two, one went to number three, and one went to number 30. The lack of input from the rest of the band wound up tearing apart the band, despite their commercial success. And this is why, despite their huge level of success during this short period, the band only wound up lasting 4 years as Creedence Clearwater Revival before the band wound up falling apart and John Fogerty took off for his solo career. But in 1969, the band was on fire, following John Fogerty's excellent instincts, even if they didn't like it. They liked the money. Let's listen to one more track from this album. Enjoy.
But you better not complain, boy. You get in trouble with the man. Let the midnight special shine a light on me. Let the midnight special shine a light on me.
Finally, for this episode, is my number 11 favorite album of 1969, which was by the Allman Brothers Band. And here we have yet another self-titled debut album. This album was titled Allman Brothers Band. As Led Zeppelin was busy remaking the blues into the hardest rock in the world, the Allman Brothers were digging down deep into the roots of the music and fusing it with jazz and hints of Southern country music to create a sound that would become known as Southern rock. The Allman Brothers Band was integrated, which was still a radical statement in the 1960s South. But it wasn't a fact that the band ever particularly remarked on. It wasn't a political thing for them. It was just a natural decision based on the music that they were making. Duane and Greg Allman had grown up fascinated by the blues, and they learned to play by copying black recording stars and by jamming with local black musicians. This debut album introduced the world to the intricate melodic touch of Duane Allman's guitar work, as well as the terrific songwriting of Greg Allman. Greg also happened to be one of the most naturally gifted blues vocalists of all time. Even before tragedy had struck this band with the double loss of Duane, as well as their original bass player, Barry Oakley, to a pair of motorcycle accidents in the early 70s, Greg was already able to invoke an entire universe of trouble and pain into his soulful singing style. Most people tend to point to the song Whipping Post as the key track on this album. But I have to admit, I've always found Whipping Post to be a bit overblown, even at times a bit tedious, especially in virtually every cover version I've ever heard of the song. Nobody else can seem to do it right, in my opinion. Sometimes I feel. For me, the key track on this debut album is the delicate and intricate song Dreams. Dreams can go somewhere new every single time it's played, while Whipping Post tends to just keep retreading the same limited ideas time after time that it was played. Also on this album is the song It's Not My Cross to Bear, which is a timeless blues shuffle that really highlights Greg Allman's remarkable songwriting talents, as well as his excellent, soulful vocals. We'll end this episode with a sample of Greg singing It's Not My Cross to Bear now. Please join me again next week when I will reveal my top 10 favorite albums of 1969. I hope you've been enjoying this review, and I hope you'll be back. As always, if you want to get a hold of me, you can send email to tony@roadtojamnation.com, or you can join my Facebook group called Road to Jam Nation, or you can also find me on Elon Musk's X, where I log in just under my actual name of Tony Kurilic. Thanks for listening. Now here's It's Not My Cross to Bear by the Allman Brothers. Enjoy! You alone.